Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 19. 2 Samuel 19. We've been moving through 1 and 2 Samuel very slowly. I can't even tell you when we began this, but it's been a while. And we have been learning a lot about the history of Israel, the coming up of David, the king, and the things that he faced along the way. It's been a real roller coaster of ups and downs for him and for the nation. Israel is the promised land. This is the area of the globe that God promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, long before there were such thing as Jews. All right? Abraham was not a Jew. There was no such thing as Jewish people, no such thing as Hebrews. God came to a man named Abram and said, Abram, you leave your father's house. I'm going to go and take you to a land that I will show you when we get there. Over the course of time and through much back and forth, finally the people of God came to the promised land. By the time they got there, Abraham's family grew extensively. Millions now of Jews existed through Abraham. And that meant that the territory of Israel was divided up into 12 sections, tribes, if you will. And at this point in the narrative, in 2 Samuel chapter 19, we're at a point in Israel's history where the kingdom is a bit divided. There is the northern section, which consists of 10 tribes, and the southern section, which consists of 2 tribes. The northern section would be called Israel, and the southern section would be called Judah. So it's a divided country, and we take note of that as we go along because it will play into tonight's discussion. Now, just to bring you up to speed, what's been happening here is David has come to be king of Israel after a long drama between him and the former king, Saul. But David now has established his kingship in that country, and yet there's been a lot of turmoil within his own family. His son Absalom staged a rebellion and drew much of Israel after himself. David was threatened to the point that he had to flee the country and has been for some time now outside of the boundary of Israel. Now his son has died through a battle that they have fought within their own ranks. Absalom the son is dead. He is no longer a threat to David, and David now has the opportunity to return to Israel and reestablish himself as king. So that's where we sit as we begin in chapter 19. Reading through some commentaries in preparation for this study, a lot of the commentators have titled this chapter, The Return of the King. The Return of the King. It's all about David coming back to Israel. I look at this and I see something in here that we need to address as Christians, if you're a Christian, as individuals. And it's not so much his return to us, it's not the return of the king, but our return to him. Our returning to the king. And we're going to see a lot of this theme play out over the course of the chapter. I'll read a few verses here and then we'll come back and discuss this a little bit. I'm going to start out in the first 8 verses, beginning in verse 1. In chapter 19 it says, And Joab is the commander of David's army. Joab was told, Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. Absalom is his son. If you back up to the last verse of the previous chapter in 33 there, this is when Absalom was killed and David learned about it. It says, Then the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and he wept. And as he went, he said thus, Oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son. The repetitive nature of his grieving declarations gives us an idea of how deeply moved he was over the sorrow of the death of his son. It carries on into chapter 19 where Joab is being told now that the king is still weeping and mourning for Absalom. In verse 2 it says, So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. I mean, they had just won a major battle. This should have been a time of rejoicing. I mean, if you're a military individual, when your country takes one, you're like, yay! But instead, they're mourning because their leader, King David, is mourning. The people heard it said that day, the king is grieved for his son. In verse 3 it says that the people then stole back into the city that day as people who are ashamed steal away when they flee in battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried out with a loud voice, "O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son." And then Joab came into the house of the king, and he said to the king, "Today you have disgraced all your servants who today have saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your own wives, and the lives of your concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends. For you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants. For today I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all of us had died today, then it would have pleased you well. Now therefore arise, go out, and speak comfort to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, not one will stay with you this night. And that will be worse for you than all the evil that has befallen you from your youth until now." So then the king arose and sat in the gate. And they told all the people, saying, "There is the king sitting in the gate." So all the people came before the king, for every one of Israel had fled to his tent. You get the scenario here. David is just beside himself and can't get over the death of his son. So somebody has to speak into his life and go, "Listen, dude, you gotta get it together. I mean, you have turned what should be a day of rejoicing into a day of mourning, and people are actually embarrassed. They are ashamed. They're sorry that they won this thing for you. I mean, you're making them feel bad that they actually did a good job." And so he advises David here with pretty strong language. "You better go and do something about this, or you're going to lose your entire army. No one's going to serve you anymore." And so here what we see in this is, first of all, the trap that personal emotions can become. You may have found this to be true. Emotions are a pretty strong motivator. They'll guide you through life if you let them. And emotions, if you let them, will guide you into some pretty dangerous places, into some pretty, fairly precarious, I'll say, situations. They don't protect you. Feelings don't protect you. They actually make you vulnerable more than you'd like to be made vulnerable. And here's David now about to lose everything that he's got. Why? Because of emotions. And you can't hardly blame the guy either. I mean, he has just been devastated by the loss of his son, and it makes sense that he would be crying about it and mourning and weeping and all the rest, but it's gone too far. Emotions can entrap a person. Another thing we see in this passage is the value of listening to a voice other than your own. I mean, David, come on. You got to snap out of it. Of course, he's not going to snap out of it, because once you start going on that track, it's really hard to get off that track until somebody comes in from the outside and, like, steers you clear, right? An object in motion stays in motion unless acted upon by another force. Something has to stop you, man. Listen, and that's why God would have you surround yourself with wise counsel. I don't know if you are aware of this, but you can most often find wise counsel in the church. Okay? Not at the bar. You're not going to find it there. Some of you, you ain't going to find it in your own family. Okay? They don't have it any more together than anybody else. You ain't going to find it in half your friends, and you're not going to find it from your coworkers. God has established the church as a place where Christians can go to hold one another accountable, to counsel one another wisely, to worship the Lord together, and to sit under similar teaching. That is the church in its essence. It's a place of protection. And you need people in your life who are able to, if you'll let them, speak into your life to protect you from harm. That's exactly what Joab is doing for David. Probably kind of sketchy for Joab to speak this way to David, but somebody had to. Somebody had to reason with this guy. The third thing we see in this is the importance of doing what we know to be right over what we might feel like doing. David actually listens to Joab's counsel, and he goes and he sits in the gate, which is the place of meeting in a town, in a city. He sits in the gate, and all the people come to him. They kind of come out of their tents going, "Well, we're sorry we won. You know, are you going to yell at us? I mean, are we okay?" And David doesn't tell us what David said, but it's implied that he spoke encouragement, and he praised them for the work that they had done and the service that they had offered. He didn't feel like doing that, but according to wise counsel, he did do it because he knew in his mind that it was right. Sometimes it comes down to knowledge over feelings, what you know to be right over what you feel might be right. Okay? We'll move on from there in verse 9 where it says, "Now all the people were in a dispute throughout all the tribes of Israel." Remember, there are many tribes, dozen. "Saying, 'The king saved us from the hand of our enemies. He delivered us from the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled from the land because of Absalom. But Absalom, who we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now, therefore, why do you say nothing about bringing back the king?'" Okay? These individuals here in Israel, the citizens of that country, they were quick to give their allegiance to Absalom, who was the rebellious son that tried to stage a coup against his own father, the king. Israel quickly and foolishly gave this man their allegiance. Okay? God worked it so that he would be killed. That was God's doing. Thus taking away this false king that they were giving their loyalty to. And now that they had finally come to their senses, they're realizing, well, David's actually our king. Maybe we should ask him to come back and have authority over us again. Hey, maybe we were a bit stupid back there. Maybe it wasn't the right thing to go after Absalom. Maybe we should go back and get David. And so they're coming back to their senses here a little bit. They want David back. It's interesting, though, that they're only going to have David back when and not until the false king failed them. They gave their allegiance and their loyalty and their devotion to a quick, up-and-coming, good-looking thing, king. And then when that king kind of ran its own course and destroyed himself, it came to nothing, then they're like, you know what, maybe we should ask for David back. And there's a real deep spiritual carryover here into our lives. It happens so often in our hearts where if we have allegiance, as if you're a Christian, your allegiance has been given to King Jesus. And yet how many of us will be persuaded to give our allegiance to some other pseudo-king that looks good for a moment, and we give them our allegiance or we give it our loyalty until it exhausts itself? We get arrested, we go to the hospital, she gets pregnant, we fight. It ruins itself, and then we're like, maybe I should have King Jesus come back into my life. And so here we see Israel on a nationwide level proving to us that this is the heart of man. If they all did it, we'll all do it. Okay, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. No one in here is like so stellar with their Christianity, they're like, I've never been this loyal to Jesus. If you haven't, raise your hand now. Okay. For those of you, okay, we're good then. Because your loyalty is going to be challenged. Not because Jesus is so bad. Because those false kings, those idols in our life are so incredibly alluring. They look good. They promise great things. And then we commit to them, and then they fail us. They leave us hurt. And then we're like, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Jesus, will you have me back? So here we have Israel doing that very thing. Now, at this point, I'll mention to you, they're all talk. That's all. Did you get that? In verse 9 and 10, it's all talk at this point. Hey, maybe we should have David come back now. They aren't bringing him back. They're just talking about it. That's an important detail here as we move along. In verse 11, it says, "So King sent to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, saying, 'Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Since the words of all Israel have come to the king, to his very house.'" David's like, okay, listen, Zadok, Abiathar, these are the priests, close associates of David. He's like, I want you to go back and talk to Judah, right? The southern tribes in Israel. Go talk to them and say, everybody in the northern half of the country is like, we should bring David back. Why aren't you on board with this? I mean, there's so much talk in the northern half of Israel. It's coming, it's making its way all back to, I'm hearing the rumors all the way over here in another country. Why are you so slow to get on board with us? Don't you want me back? In verse 12, he says, you are my brethren. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then are you the last to bring back the king? He says, and say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me and more also if you are not commander of the army before me continually in the place of Joab. What's interesting about this is when Absalom, David's son, staged his rebellion, Amasa, who used to be one of David's loyal military, leader of his army, he defected and went with Absalom. So Amasa kind of like flipped on David. And David's going, hey, guys, when you go back over there and you speak to the elders of Judah, I want you specifically to catch up with Amasa and tell him, listen, bro, no hard feelings. You can be my military leader again, all right? And then look at verse 14. So David swayed the hearts of all the men of Judah, just as the heart of one man, so that they sent this word to the king. Return, you and all your servants. So David's, through his words here, persuaded the hearts of men. And I want you to see clearly here that David did nothing to reclaim his position as king in their lives, did he? He didn't do anything. He could have. He could have gone over there with his entire military and all of his servants with all of their weapons and said, I'm back, suckas. What's up? You thought my son was something? He's dead now, ain't he? Bow. Bow. But he doesn't. Instead, he speaks kindly to them. Okay? He's only going to come back as their leader and their authority. He's only going to reclaim his position according to their desire to have him do so. He ain't going to force himself on anybody. He's going, I want you to want me to rule over you. And you have to understand that God has that identical attitude toward us. He will not force himself upon you. He will not violate your free will. What he'll do is change your will so that you, who used to hate him, now mysteriously want him. And how did he do it? How did David do it in the lives of these men? He did it through the mouths of two priests. David put the words into the mouths of Zadok and Abiathar, the two priests, and told them to go and tell the others what David wanted them to know. And in hearing those words, the hearts of those men were swayed. Did you know that God reaches you and I in the exact same way? Through the mouths of those who faithfully preach the gospel. God puts into the mouths of men and women the truth of the Bible. And through their declaration of the facts about God, others will hear about God and their hearts will be swayed. God changes your will through good teaching and good preaching. That's how it works. If you don't believe that, listen to what Romans 10 says. In verses 11, 12, and 13, it says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But how can they call on him to save them unless they believe in him? And how can they believe in him if they've never heard about him? And how can they hear about him unless someone tells them? And how will anyone go and tell them without being sent? That's why the scriptures say, how beautiful are the feet of messengers who bring the good news. This happens through preaching and teaching. This is why it's so important that you sit under teaching that is biblical. And this is why it's so important that when you learn the truth of God, you share it with others who haven't heard. In Ephesians chapter 1, verse 13, it says, in him you also, when you heard the word of truth, when you heard it, the gospel of your salvation, and believed in him, then you were sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise. When were you sealed with the Holy Spirit of promise? When you believed in him. When did you believe in him? When you had faith. When did you have faith? When you heard about him. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. You cannot be saved unless you are hearing biblical truth. Somehow, what's in this book has to get into your brain. And God often commissions the mouths of men and women to put it there. We see this happening as David commissions Zadok and Abiathar to go and speak to all of Judah and tell them this. And tell them this. In verse 15 it says, "Then the king returned and came to the Jordan." The Jordan River separates Israel from foreign lands, and David was on the opposite side of the Jordan. Okay? It's like a county line. It's like a state line. It's like, you know, here in Canada, you got the boundary waters. All right? So David is on the other side of the Jordan, and he's going to return. And it says he returned. He came to the Jordan River, and Judah came to Gilgal to go to meet the king, to escort the king across the Jordan. Now, and Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. We'll get to this guy in a second, Shimei. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him, and they went over the Jordan before the king. You know what's interesting about these mentions here? Ziba, in verse 17, we've dealt with him before. We read about him in chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. Ziba is the one who was a servant to a man named Mephibosheth, who was Saul's only surviving relative that David caught up to and showed great kindness to. Mephibosheth, we learn, is lame in his feet. Okay, he's not a very mobile individual, especially before they had cars. So the guy can't really get around. Ziba came to David when Absalom was staging the rebellion, and Ziba, Mephibosheth's servant, came to David without his master and lied to David. Do you guys remember this? You were here? Ziba told David, "Hey, listen, my master, Mephibosheth, you thought you were friends? He ain't your friend. He actually is going to take advantage of the situation that you're in right now, and he's going to stage his own little coup." And David's like, "Whoa, serious?" And without hearing both sides of the story, David says, "Well then, all the land is yours. I'll give you everything." Man, I can't believe that guy. What would do that for? And Ziba's like, "I don't know. He's a liar." And now that Absalom is dead, and he hears that David's coming back, he's like, "Oh, crap." So he actually rushes to the Jordan to meet David and escort him home. Yeah, I suppose so. So Ziba the liar returns to the king. What we're going to see in the rest of this text, our chapter this evening, is people returning to the king. Okay? That's what this message is about. And we're going to see how certain individuals return to the king. Because Ziba was a liar. Dude just forsook his allegiance to King David, and now he's returning to King David. How's he doing it? Well, not a lot on this guy, but one, he returns with silence. He didn't say anything to David, at least not that we read about here. So he returns with silence. I don't know what that means. Perhaps he had nothing to say to David. You know, "I've just been lying to you through my teeth. I don't know what to say." We also know that he returns with a bit of mystery. I mean, he's bringing his sons and his servants with him, and I don't know why, and the Bible doesn't tell us why. But he's got kind of an entourage. He's got his whole family with him. I don't know why, but there's some mystery there. Maybe it's a repentant heart. Maybe he feels threatened and he has his defenses lined up. I don't know. But he's returning to the king. And then we've got Shimei. Okay? In verse 18 it says, "A ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan." It's quite a character, the Shimei. We read about him earlier in chapter 16, verses 5 through 13. You can read it, or I'll just tell you about it. This is the guy, if you remember, that really couldn't stand David. And David was kind of on the run from his son. He had no authority in the lives of anybody anymore. And Shimei just came along kicking up dirt at David and throwing rocks at him and cursing him up and down. Shimei took it upon himself to really humiliate David. I mean, this is like Obama does something you don't particularly care for, and you know, when he comes out of the White House, there's you. You know, like, you, meh. It's like, geez, that's bold. You know? So that's Shimei. He takes advantage of David while David's down. And now David's rising back up to power, and Shimei's like, uh-oh. Now, he might be mad at me. I hope he doesn't remember what I did to him when I was throwing rocks at him. You know, this could be bad for me and everybody I know. So he comes back, and he says in verse 19, he said to the king, do not let my lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. Please don't take it personal. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down and meet my lord the king. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this because he cursed the Lord's anointed? And David said, well, I'll get to that in a second. Abishai is one of David's military men. And it's funny because in the original account, when Shimei was throwing rocks at David and kicking up dirt and stuff, it was that same Abishai that was like, he can't treat you like this, David. Let me slice his head off. So now, yeah, and so now, so it's like whether Shimei's in sin or whether he's repentant and apologetic, Abishai's like, let's kill him. It's like, okay, dude, hothead. So anyway, David answers him in verse 22 and says, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over all Israel? Therefore the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king swore to him. The king didn't swear at him, like, I remember you. No, he swore to him, saying, I promise you're safe. All right? He grants him forgiveness. So you see Ziba returning to the king. Here we see Shimei, who has kind of bad blood between him and King David, returning to the king. And Shimei, this mocker, who was once a mocker, we see him returning with submission, because the Bible says here that he fell down before the king. I mean, there was a bit of humility there. He returns with confession. He admits all that he did wrong. He says, the wrong that your servant did. And by the way, he's being specific about his. It's not general, like, you know, I'm a sinner. It was, I did this, and this was wrong. Very specific. He also comes with haste. Haste means he hurried. I mean, he knew he had to make it right with David, and he's like, I ain't wasting time. He says, I am the first. He says, here I am. I'm the first one to get here out of all the house of Joseph. I hustled to get here because I knew I was in the wrong, and I am pleading for your forgiveness. We can learn something from this guy. He comes with submission. He comes with confession. He comes with haste. We read on from there in verse 24. Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. Oh, hey, you guys remember Ziba? Do you remember Ziba? Ziba is the servant of Mephibosheth, who caught up to David a while back and lied to David about Mephibosheth. Because remember, Mephibosheth is lame in his feet and isn't too mobile. Finally, Mephibosheth is catching up to David. Ziba's already there and going, oh no. This is the last thing that Ziba wanted. His master to show up. The other side of the story to enter the picture. Like, oh, wonderful. So Mephibosheth shows up. In the middle of the verse it says, he had not cared for his feet. He's lame in his feet. I don't know what that means. Didn't wash his feet, didn't trim his toenails. Just sick. Nor trimmed his mustache. Nor washed his clothes. Whew. Smell him coming. From the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. Yikes. So this guy is filthy. So it was when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king said to him, he didn't kiss him on the cheek, by the way, which would have been a common greeting in Israel. He's like, stand back, man. Woo-hoo! Right? Instead, he says, why didn't you go with me, Mephibosheth? Like, when I was on the run, why didn't you come with me? Which implies that he could have. Like, yeah, he's lame in both his feet, but the king can certainly provide you with a horse or a chariot or something. Like, I could have commissioned a few dudes to carry you. You could have been with me if you really wanted to. Why weren't you there? So David is a little bit miffed. Plus, he still has the lie that Ziba told him floating around in his brain. So right now, him and Mephibosheth aren't on very good terms like they used to be. What's up with you, dude? You betrayer? Why'd you do this to me? That hurt. And he answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me. Now, Ziba's standing by going, oh, no. For your servant said, he's saying, Ziba lied. Ziba said, I'll saddle a donkey for myself and so that I may ride on it and go to the king because I'm lame and can't. And he has slandered your servant. He slandered me to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king? Mephibosheth here is going, listen, David, when we first met, I thought you were going to kill me because I was related to Saul, who was once your enemy. And I alone am alive in the family, and I would then pose a threat to your throne. I thought for sure I was a dead man. That's why I hid from you. I thought you were going to slaughter me just to quell any threat that I might have in your mind posed to your lordship. And yet, instead of killing me, you gave me a place at your own table, and even though I'm lame, you treated me like I was a king. He's like, so you can do whatever you want to me. I mean, I believe the lie or don't believe the lie. In fact, you could take everything away from me, and I've still gotten from you more than I ever deserved in the first place. So the king said to him, why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said you and Ziba divide the land. David's going, I'm not going to take anything away from you. I already said that you and your servant, you can have all of it divided up between the two of you. And then Mephibosheth said to the king, rather, let him take it all. Inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house, he's going, Ziba, even though he dissed me, even though he lied to me, he can have all the land. He goes, it means nothing to me. What really matters to me is you, David. You coming back and re-establishing your kingship in my world, that's all I want. I don't care about what you have to offer. I care about you. And this man here, Mephibosheth, really establishes for you and I some of the fundamentals of returning to the king when in our heart we've gone astray after idols. And what we see out of him, he returns with remorse. He returns with remorse. First of all, what was his sin? Why should he return with such a demeanor? Well, his sin was with that he didn't go with David when he had the chance. Instead, he let someone else more qualified do it. And how many Christians are guilty of that? Jesus is asking you of your loyalty. He's going, step forward with me. Let's go to war together. Come on, man, let's fight. And you're going, but I'm lame. I don't have anything to offer. There's far more people out there that are far more qualified than me. I'm going to let somebody else serve you. Jesus is going, be a good steward of the resources I've given you. And we sit back and go, I'm going to let somebody else tithe. I'm going to let somebody else fund the work of the kingdom. I'm going to let somebody else do it. I'm going to let somebody else give of their time. I'm going to let somebody else give their life. I'm going to let somebody else lay everything down. I'm going to let somebody else walk away from what's precious to them in order to go and serve God. That's a sin. And Mephibosheth, as wonderful as he is, committed that very sin. Well, I'm lame. You know, it's hard for me to get around. So I'm just going to sit tight at home. I'll let somebody else go. Ziba, why don't you go? He returns with remorse. He returns with humility. Okay, I already mentioned that he acknowledges to David that David has already been way better to him than he ever deserved. David's already given him far more than he would ever have expected. He returns with genuineness. Remorse, humility, and genuineness. Genuine in the sense that he doesn't want what David can give him. He wants David himself. Mephibosheth is just happy that David's back, man. That's all I wanted. I just want this relationship to be reestablished. In verse 31, we read about somebody else. His name is Barzillai. It says, Barzillai, the Gileadite, came down from Rogalim and went across the Jordan with the king to escort him across the Jordan. Now, this Barzillai, he's somebody that we've met before as well. If you go back to chapter 17, if you read through in verses 27 through 29, you're going to read that there was a few individuals that came to David in a time of need and provided him with all kinds of food and refreshment and sustenance that revived them in their time of running. Barzillai was one of them. So it says that Barzillai comes to the Jordan River to escort the king across. In verse 32, it says, now Barzillai was a very aged man, about 80 years old, and he had provided the king with supplies while he stayed at Maanaim, for he was a very rich man. So he could afford to do this. This is interesting because Barzillai stands in very sharp contrast to who you and I might know as the rich young ruler. Jesus was approached by a man who was rich and young and powerful. He had authority. He was a ruler. And he comes to Jesus and he says, hey man, what do I got to do to go to heaven? And Jesus says, don't kill anybody, don't lie to anybody, and don't take anybody's stuff. And he's like, got it. I've been doing that since I was a kid. And Jesus goes, awesome. Go have a huge garage sale, sell everything that you've got, and then take what you've gained and give it to poor people. And the rich young ruler is like, no. Bible says he goes away sad. No garage sale, no donations, just goes back to his dry, stale religion where he doesn't kill anybody. Pretty good person. Here you have quite the opposite. Instead of a rich young ruler, you've actually got a rich old nobody. Barzillai is a rich old nobody. He's 80 years old, and he's a nobody because in Ezra chapter 2, verses 61 through 63, you actually read that this guy lost his lineage. He lost the paperwork so that his family couldn't even be counted in the census, and they were disqualified from certain areas of ministry because there was no record that they were even Jews. He got lost. Nobody even knows who this dude is. He's a rich old nobody, but he knows what to do with his riches. With his riches, he supplies to those in need, and he did it, and he won favor with God and with man. And he comes back to David now, and he says, I'd like to help you some more. And listen to this. The king says to Barzillai in verse 33, come across with me, and I'll provide for you while you are with me in Jerusalem. But Barzillai says to the king, how long have I to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? He's like, I'm 80 years old today. Can I discern between the good and bad? He's like, I'm losing my mind, man. I don't know. I'm kind of an old dude. Can your servant taste what I eat or drink? He's like, you can give me all the delicacies that are available to you as a king, but I can't tell the difference between caviar and mac and cheese. So what is, I mean, you know, just give me my pureed peas and I'll be fine. Can I hear any longer the voice of singing men and singing women? He's like, I can't hear, I can't see, I'm an old man. He says, why then should your servant be a further burden to my lord the king? He considers himself a burden to the king. He says, your servant will go a little way across the Jordan with the king. And why should the king repay me with such a reward? Why should the king repay me? Listen, man, I caught up with you when you were at your time of need, and I gave you a bunch of stuff, but I didn't expect for you to repay me. Please let your servant turn back again, that I may die in my own city, near the grave of my father and mother. He says, but here is your servant Chimham. It's likely that this is his son. Okay? Barzillai is recorded in the book of Ezra as having sons and daughters. This is likely that it's his son, and I'll get to that in a second. He says, here is my servant, your servant Chimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king, and do for him what seems good to you. And the king answered, Chimim shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what seems good to you. Now whatever you request of me, I will do for you. And then all the people went over the Jordan, and when the king had crossed over, the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. So here we have Barzillai, the rich old nobody, returning to the king, because we saw him interact with the king in a previous chapter, and now he's returning to the king. First of all, he returns with generosity. Okay, we caught that, didn't we? He was a very generous man. He gave out of his abundance. He gave to those in need. He gave to people in a time of want, and he expected nothing in return. That's generosity. We went through this a couple Sundays ago in church here, where when you give expecting something in return, that doesn't make you a generous giver. That makes you a shrewd investor. He returns with generosity. He also returns with wisdom. Okay, I'm going to suggest to you that Chimim was his son. And in wisdom and foresight, he's providing for his son in the light of his own coming death. He says, I'm not going to let this offer, King David, go to waste. But it ain't going to be any good for me. I'm about dead. But how about my son? How about your servant, Chimim? Would you take good care of him? So he returns with generosity, he returns with wisdom, and he returns with honesty. I mean, this is pretty exemplary for you and I when we return to Jesus, because Barzillai understands that he is not as much of an asset to the king as he is a burden to the king. Now, I'm not going to be much help to you. In fact, if anything, I'm going to hold you back, dude. I mean, I'm 80 years old. Do you know what incontinent means? You're a king. You shouldn't be changing diapers. I mean, I need hospice is what I need. Okay, I don't need a palace. He understands that he's a burden to the king. Now, isn't it true that you and I in our hearts want to think that we're such an asset to the Lord? Man, it's good thing for him I'm on his team. Okay? And if he doesn't give me what I want, I just might withhold my worship. I'm going to strong arm him into providing for me the things that I would like to have in my life. And if he doesn't, I'm out. And boy, is he going to cry, because we all know that I was first picked. I mean, I'm awesome. I can kick that spiritual ball right out of the park. And God's like, ooh, you're a bit of a burden, in fact. I don't like to remind you of this too often, but sometimes when you're up on your high horse, you need to be knocked down a little bit, and you need to realize that I had to die for you. Okay? The only thing you gave me was your sins. Okay? Everything else belonged to me from the beginning, including your breath. So whatever I have that I think I'm being so awesome for giving to the Lord is nothing that wasn't his to begin with. Go, oh Lord, I give you my life. God's like, I know. And if you didn't, I'd take it sooner or later. Well, Lord, I'm just going to give you my allegiance. I'm going to give you my devotion. And God's like, yeah, I'm responsible for that. I changed your will. I made you want to do that. If it wasn't for God, I wouldn't give him anything. That's the sad truth. And because of God, I have everything. So if I have to be honest, then I must, like Barzillai here, confess that I am more of a burden to God than an asset. And what that does then is instills within me a deep appreciation that he lets me do anything at all. Like God lets me play ball on his team? Just nobody tell him how awful I am at the sport, okay? I'm not that good with this thing that's called Christian service. Don't tell him, though, because he's letting me in. And he lets me serve him. That's astounding that he would let anybody do that. Because if you ask me, Jesus would do a far better job if we were all out of the picture and he did it alone. All I do is screw up. All I do is make a mess of things. It's like letting my son into the garage if I'm going to change the oil. I'm going to do it because I love him, but boy, you know, he's knocking stuff over and putting rocks in the pan, and, you know, I mean, I don't know what's going on. I mean, I'm last summer I'm trying to build stuff. I was building a fence, just like a gate and stuff. And I'm trying to pull nails and everything, and he is totally in the way. And I love him so much that I'm okay with it, kind of. And so what... So what's going on is I got a bucket full of tools, and there's a couple jars of nails in there, and one of the jars broke, and it's just full of broken glass. So I had to take everything out and clean up the glass, and I set everything over here on the table, and the second jar of nails was on the table. And of course, while I was cleaning up the first jar, he got the second jar, and then I had to clean up that one. And then I sliced my finger, and I'm bleeding, and I swear to you, I got nothing done but cleaned up broken glass. But I tell you, the value in having him help me may not be shown in the work that I'm able to get done, but it will be seen for all of eternity in what it does for my son. And does not God treat his sons and daughters in a similar way? Come on, you have to admit that you're not helping with these, you know, great strides in the kingdom of God because of my ability. God's like, no, no, no. I'm letting you do this. And that is to God's glory that he would let us do these things. And Barzillai, whoever this dude is, has the right attitude. In verse 40 it says, now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah escorted the king, and also half the people of Israel. Pay close attention to the words in verse 40. All the people of Judah, okay, all the people of Judah, and also half the people of Israel. Okay, so remember, Israel is divided. There's north and there's south. All of the southern half and half of the people in the north. Just then, all of the men of Israel, the northern half, okay, who only had half of the people there to escort him across the river, the other half come to the king, and they said to the king, why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king, his household, and all David's men with them across the Jordan? So all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative of ours. Why then are you angry over this matter? Have we ever eaten at the king's expense? Or has he ever given us any gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 shares in the king, 10 tribes. Therefore, we have also way more right to David than you do. He's ours. They get into this bickering contest. Why then do you despise us? Were we not the first to advise bringing back our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. Here now you've got two halves of a country fighting over this. You've got all of Judah and half of Israel. And the half of those who didn't go to escort him across the river now are moved to jealousy because of the full devotion of the people in the southern half of the country. They're all there showing their devotion. They're all there showing their loyalty. They're all there showing their commitment. And then the ones that isn't, they're like, hey, wait a second. What are you doing serving so loyally? That makes me look bad. What? Hey, come on. Why didn't you invite us? And my question would be, well, where were you? Did you not know of this? I mean, remember verses 9 and 10? They were all talk. Remember? Take note of that, man. They were all talk. And for half of them, it was always just all talk. See, but the men of Judah, they were slow to be convinced. They were slow to be convinced to let the king back into their life. Remember, David had to send Zadok and Abiathar the priests to go and convince them. But once they were convinced, they were more than just talk. They were action. Their hearts were swayed, and their loyalty was shown to David once again, and they went to escort him across the river en masse, all of them together. And yet these talkers back here are going, yeah, we should bring David back. Yeah, we should bring David back. Somebody should go get David. We should have David back. And then somebody actually goes and serves the king by bringing him back, and they're all like, hey, what are you doing? Interesting how that can work out for us. Jesus will only return when he's invited. Jesus will only return when he's invited. The question then today is, do you want him to be your king? I mean, it's easy to say yes, isn't it? But I think we have to look at the way in which these individuals returned to Jesus, because the way that you approach Jesus reflects what desire you have or don't have. And everyone in this room is guilty of giving their allegiance to false kings from time to time. Okay? So don't be surprised when it happens, and don't feel like you're, you know, out of the club if it has. Our hearts are prone to straying, to wandering, to giving our loyalty to idols, things that don't deserve them, things that leave us broken and hurt. But if you're a Christian, we must return to Christ, even if, like Ziba, we've lied to him. We must return to Christ, even if, like Shimei, we've mocked him, thrown dirt at him, completely cursed him out. Maybe we've been half-hearted like Israel. Return to him. Maybe we've been idolaters like Judah. Return to him. Maybe you're like Barzillai. You're not so much an asset to him, but you're actually more of a burden. Return to him. See, he'll take you. You don't have to be awesome. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be spotless to return to Christ. Jesus says, you're just the people I'm looking for. David isn't being partial here, going, well, I don't like you. I'll take you, but not you. He's going, anybody that is willing to show me loyalty, well, it's been a long time. I'll gladly have you back. I swear to you, I won't kill you. Listen, it's water under the bridge. I accept you back. If you'll have me, I'll have you. And did you know that God has the same sentiments toward us when we've gone off in sin? The Bible says in James 4:8, you return to God and he'll return to you. You return to him and he will return to you. In that verse, who is it that takes the first step? You. You return to God. You invite him back into your life. You return and you do it with humility. You do it with wisdom. You do it with submission. You do it in all the ways that we see these men returning to David, and David will, God will have you back. Jesus will return to you. He's not going to hold a grudge. You might need to hear that. Some of you think that God is a grudge holder. Well, I did something really bad, and now I just have to kind of like pay him off. You know, graduate successfully. You know, read my Bible more. You ever done that? Like you've done something yesterday, you feel guilty, so today I'm gonna read like 10 chapters this morning. Because, you know, I got to pay him off. I'm going to start going to church again. I'm going to start praying some more. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that for God. It's like God ain't holding grudges. You don't have to do anything. You just go to him again and go, I'm sorry. God's like, I know you're sorry. I knew that before you even screwed up. I'll take you back. I'll take you back. Will you return to him? Will you return to him? And maybe in your mind you're thinking, well, I don't have to return to him. I haven't really done anything. Okay, you will. And when you do, will you return to him? He'd love to have you. I don't know if you know this, but Jesus wants to be king in your life. Just tired of competing with idols and silly false kings and all these things that claim your allegiance. It's like, listen, man, I'm good. I'd be good to you. I'll take you back if you'll have me. I mean, in all of Israel's history, they've never had a king like David. He's the best. Why would anyone turn away from David? I don't know. Wicked hearts. Same as you and I have. Why would anybody turn away from Jesus? Is Jesus not good? He's awesome. We know that. Go to him. Return to him. Listen, if anybody in here is kind of in their heart or in their life split, worship false gods, given their allegiance to someone or something else, return. He'll have you. All right? Jesus Christ will have you back. And he won't hold grudges. All right? That's the bottom line in all of this. He'll take you. He's waiting.